Welcome to the Speak Up Talk Radio Network, home of the Firebird Book Awards, the Positive Change Podcast Awards, Hall of Fame, and this podcast, Authors on Fire. I am Pat Rulo. Today, I'm thrilled to have author Thomas Jared Hayes with me, and his Firebird Honorable Recognition book is titled From Mill to Museum, the Grassroots Preservation Effort for the Grist Mill in Delta, Ontario, Canada. Jared graduated from the University of Ottawa with an MA in history. He currently lives in the Ottawa Valley and works in the records and information management field. Since publishing his first book, From Mill to Museum, in 2021, he has been working on a second book about Anglican Bishop John Strachan of Toronto and British American relations in the years following the American War of Independence. And I am looking forward to learning some Canadian history today. So welcome to the network, Jared.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Oh my gosh, it's my pleasure, and congratulations on the honorable recognition win. I was happy to share that with you.
Thank you again. Again, it's quite an honor.
Oh, this is quite a book, From Mill to Museum, the Grassroots Preservation Effort for the Grist Mill in Delta, Ontario, Canada. Very, very specific. What was the inspiration? What inspired you to write this book about this grist mill in Delta, Ontario?
Well, I grew up in the area. I have a family connection to it, especially since it's a local landmark. And you can't miss it. It's right in the middle of the village. And whenever I'd go to visit my father's family, you'd always see it every time he passed by. And then after I went to university and was looking for work during the summer, I was hired there as a museum interpreter and later as a student archivist. And I worked there from 2016 to 2020 when I was getting my bachelor's and then my master's during the summer. And the one thing I noticed is that they do a great job with historical interpretation, but the one thing that was missing was the story of how it actually became a museum. Why was this place considered important enough to become a museum and then a national historic site? And I was worried because this all happened in the 60s and 70s when it became both, that this story we lost forever because a lot of people that were involved had unfortunately passed away or were at the very minimum in their 80s. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to make sure that this story was preserved for future generations because it's quite interesting.
Wow, how good of you to for that to even occur to you and then to take on that project, because I know that that obviously takes quite a bit of time. But because it's family, it's kind of a family place to you, I could see how it could be close to your heart. I imagine, though, that the research process was quite intense and that perhaps there were some challenges that you faced. So maybe give us a little peek into how you went about researching all of this.
Well, exactly. And then to add to the problem, then the lockdowns happened, so I couldn't access a lot of the archives that I wanted. So the project was delayed a little bit, but it ended up working out in the end. The number one research that I did, the primary research I did, was oral interviews. So I talked to three people that were involved in the process. There's one lady who's over 100, and she still drives, Beth Robinson, and she was one of the original four who originally took on the project of restoring the mill and turning it into a museum. And we had a wonderful talk, talked for several hours with her role. And then there's Anna Greenhorn, who's in her 90s, and she joined a little bit later, but she was still heavily involved. And today she still gives tours at the museum, lives alone, does really great for herself. And another gentleman who's unfortunately since passed away, Paul Fritz, he came on near the end, but he was a university professor, so he was very useful in writing letters to government officials for grants and proposals and things like that, and the early interpretation museum. So between these three individuals, I had a lot of my research completed. And then again, once I was able to get into the archives, I could access the actual physical documents and review, although unfortunately, because it's been so long since the 1960s and 70s, a lot of it had been misplaced or lost or didn't exist in the first place.
Oh, my. Those oral interviews, that is just so rich for you to have had that honor, actually, of spending time with these folks. First of all, I'm thinking that the place in itself, this mill in itself, almost acts as a character. It almost feels like a character. And then you add these three people into the mix. That's quite a dramatic time for you, I would imagine.
Exactly. And knowing not just their involvement in the mill, but listening to their stories about life in general, because it's largely connected because a lot of them, they all had a local connection as well. So seeing how my own community had evolved over time, even before the mill, they took on the project of restoring it and turning it into a museum. A lot of them had involvement as children, for instance, going to the mill and asking the miller for flour. This was before large food stores, food brand stores were even invented, right, 1930s and 40s. So listening to their stories about how it impacted them as a child and how the mill has been this focal point in the community for since 1810, quite literally.
Ever, I'm thinking about how these three characters plus the place feels like a character. Did you ever consider fictionalizing it?
I have actually quite a few times. One of the gentleman, Paul Fritz, who was the former professor, retired professor, who's unfortunately passed away, he gave me all of his notes in history. And one of the things that when he knew he was quite sick, he gave me an idea that he never got around to was creating a story about the village itself and what it would have been like in the early 1800s, how village life would have been, and then making a story around that using all of his notes. And even though it'd be fictionalized, it'd be historical fiction based off of truth and even real characters.
Oh, that might be a challenge for you to come up with a historical fiction based on all of your research.
It would be quite interesting, especially tying it into all the other local communities as well.
Oh, I hope you do that. That would be kind of neat.
Thank you for the idea. Thank you.
I'm just piling some more work on you here. Easy for me to do. I'll just sit back and wait. You talked about community involvement. How did the local community become involved in the preservation effort, and what role did they play in the story you tell?
Well, when the mill first closed down in 1960, so it survived from 1810 approximately. We're not sure exactly. It might have been 1808. But we know for sure 1810, so that's the date we use. All the way through, even through the Great Depression until 1960 when it closed its doors. And the four people that took on the project were locals. So what happened is that the last miller at the time, Hastings Steele was his name, he was in his 80s, and he had to close up because of his age. And also he was in poor health. His health was deteriorating, and the building itself was in bad shape. So he just decided to close the door and go into retirement at his age. And so he approached four people, the one being Elizabeth Robinson, the others being Albert Fry, Mildred Sweet, and Robert Tuck. And they were either summer cottagers who'd come down to spend their summer on the lakes, or locals themselves who owned and operated a farm. Albert Fry and Mildred Sweet operated the local hardware store. And so he approached them about the idea of turning it into a museum. And since, again, it's such a focal point, and as they were growing up, they had such connections to the mill, they agreed on the condition that it was turned into a museum. So he ended up deeding it to them for $1. And as time went on, people started hearing about their story, and more people started joining and giving their support. Another large early support was a gentleman by the name of Harold Russell. And so he was a World War I veteran and a teacher in Toronto. And after retiring, he moved to Delta, back to Delta, as you say, because he was born. And he was very active in his local community. And as soon as he found out that they were planning on restoring the mill, he joined right away. And he was more or less the primary mover and shaker. If you don't mind, I'd like to read a quote about Harold Russell, talking about how important he was. So this is from Anna Greenhorn, one of the ladies I interviewed. Harold Russell was a teacher, I think, in Toronto, and Harold was a real. He set his mind on something, he'd get it, or anyone in his way would die while he got it. And when he retired, he got interested in the mill. He joined it. They had a lot of negotiations where Harold went along, and I'm told that sometimes Harold's behavior was very extreme, and at the point where he'd jump up and down on a minister's floor, you know, or whatever group was handling it, and really roar at them. And of course, he did have the language, the correct English language. Go with it. And if they didn't get the point across, he had the plain, ordinary street language. And physically and mentally, he pushed. So the community was very, very supportive, especially people like Russell. And you can see as well from the donations that arrived. So between 1963 and 1970, approximately, about $4,000 were raised, which is about $48,000 in today's money, which is not a small sum for the local community. And then larger amounts were raised through when they started spreading out the donation campaign across Ontario and then Canada, and also relying on government grants. There was some opposition at first because people were worried that the mill was in such bad shape that their foundation had problems, and there was worry that one of the walls would collapse. that the building would be a safety hazard for the community, and there was an idea of tearing it down. But once they showed us that they were serious, the people that took on the project, it pretty much died away, the any opposition, and people threw their support behind it.
Interesting. What do you consider to be the most important historical aspects of the grist mill and in the decision to keep it alive?
One of the, it all depends on who you ask. Now, one of the main reasons why it was so successful is because very early on in the search for funding, I mentioned that quote from Hill Russell. When he was talking about ministers, they'd go to various government departments and ask for grants and things like that to help support their work. And one of the early things is that during this process, they contacted the Ontario Historical Foundation, and they're part of the provincial government, and their job is preserving Ontario history and heritage, either through either vocal support or, more importantly, through monetary support. And they saw the mill as a diamond in the rough. So even though it's in bad shape, it's still a very imposing site at this time. And they recommended right away that he contact the Historic Sites and Monuments Board of Canada, which was formed in 1919, and it has the goal of researching and then recommending things that might merit national historic site designation. Mm-hmm. It can also be people and places as well, and things, even ideas. And so they're kind of the main drivers of why it was important, in the sense that them adding on the designation really added legitimacy. What interested them the most is, of course, the building is, it's quite an imposing site, and it's quite old. It's 1810, one of the oldest grist mills in Ontario that we know of. But what interested them was the story of the owners, the original owners, and the people who were possibly involved with the mill. And during their research, they uncovered a gentleman by the name of Abel Stevens, and they really ran away with that idea. Even though in the end, they realized he wasn't officially connected to the mill, he was the first miller in Delta, but he owned a wooden mill down the road instead of this imposing stone mill. And what's so interesting about him is that, so he was an American loyalist from Vermont. And it's almost too, his story's almost, it's harder to decide between fact versus fiction. But as the story goes, after his brother was arrested for also being a loyalist and part of General Burgon's failed expedition in New York, he broke his brother out of prison. And then they were on the run in the wild from what would have been the Patriots at the time, the American government. And it's quite fascinating because also, too, Abel Stevens is quite the character. He would have been a Baptist preacher, an explorer, and a industrialist. So you can just imagine him screaming verses out of the Bible while he's breaking his brother out of prison. Unfortunately, we don't know much about what happened, but we do know that he was involved in his prison breakout.
Oh, my gosh. My mind is going back to your fictionalized version where you've really got a lot of action-adventure here, too.
Exactly. There's a lot you can do, especially with the characters involved.
Yes.
And again, it's just like it's almost like a Hollywood movie in some aspects, Abel Stevens' story. So that's really why the government itself really took away from that. The characters, whereas the people that were involved, the original four, they were much more interested in the building itself. Although they were interested in the stories, the people who owned the mill, they were much more interested in what the building meant to their community. But again, without this designation, it added a lot of legitimacy to the funding campaign efforts, and it really took off. That's when the mill really took off. So between 1963 and 1970, they raised approximately what would be today's money, $40,000. But between 1970 and 1973, that number increased to about $280,000. Oh. Because of this National Historic Site designation.
Mm-hmm. Sure, that was a game changer.
Exactly.
For sure. I'm wondering, just in general, just talking about old mills, not only in Canada, but in the United States, are there many? Have many been preserved, or is this a real rare situation?
So there are a few, but not quite. None of them are like the Delta Mill. What makes the Delta Mill special is that it's stone. So you have to remember, this is an industrial building. Its main purpose is to make money. And so most mills would have been made out of wood, especially earlier pioneer mills, because it's much cheaper. This is a three-story mill with Georgian architecture. So it's named after the kings at the time of England, the three Georges. And what makes it special is that it has arched windows and doors, which would have been very, very expensive at the time.
Yeah.
And so it's quite special in that regard. Another reason why it's special, though it wasn't factored into the designation process, or nobody knew about it at the time, is that we later found out it was an all-revenue automatic mill, and that's part of the reason why it's three stories. So Oliver Evans is quite a fascinating character. He's called the Watt of America, and it's really hands across borders. he was an inventor from Pennsylvania, and he invented this idea of an automatic mill. So instead of requiring an entire staff to operate your mill, you could, in theory, operate it by yourself, all mechanized. Mm. All the, normally, he would recommend still having two or three people on staff enough to check all the floors in case something went wrong. But in theory, you could automate it completely. And in the story, when he originally was selling this idea, people came to investigate his prototype mill, and they couldn't. The mill was empty, and they wanted to know who was running it. And he was out in the fields, and he showed up afterwards, and they were amazed at how he didn't even have to be on the premise for his mill to be operating. Wow. So there are quite a few reasons why this mill does stand out.
Mm-hmm. Was it preserved in stone as well?
Exactly, yes. Mm-hmm. So everything has been restored. Most of the mill, the foundation of the mill and the stone walls have been either from original 1810 or have been restored to look like they were 1810, original build.
I'm imagining that, again, there were some challenges in just the preservation efforts.
Well, exactly. So just even putting past the funding that was required, the large astronomical funds required to do it, a big problem is that even in 1970, the heritage restoration movement in both Canada and the United States was just starting to pick up, nothing like it was today. And so a lot of these practices that they noticed when they did the original restoration, 1970, and then again at a later, even though the book doesn't cover this, they did another restoration in the 1990s. They noticed that there was a lot of cut corners and things they wouldn't recommend doing. They didn't use the best practices when restoring the mill in 1970, although you wouldn't be able to tell at first glance. So it's an interesting learning process as well. But this was on the cusp of the heritage movement, restoration movement.
Mm-hmm. Just locally, how has the perception of the grist mill changed since it was first built, and how do you see its role evolving as you move forward?
Well, perfect. So originally it would have been mainly for survival, where a farmer would bring in their grains to be milled into flour and other sorts of things to eat. And so it was purely almost a commercial, but as time grew on, this building started becoming an aspect of the community. So as early as the 1810s, it was known as Delta, which today was known as Stone Mill. So you can kind of get an idea just how important this was to the community. And it started becoming a centerpiece. So around the mill, the community was built essentially. Mm-hmm. And so attached to it would have been at one point the blacksmith shop, as well as there would have been a school at one point attached to it. There also would have been a sawmill attached to the back. There would have been a distillery at one point for alcohol, because where there's mills, there's stills.
Sure.
Even though they tried regulating it, it didn't always go so well, because they'd use their extra product to ferment alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
There was a marble cutter at one point, shoe cobbler. So again, the community really grew up around, even though it started out purely commercial, the community really grew around and started to focal point view the mill. And then you can see, too, just how important the mill was. It's during the First and Second World Wars, as soldiers were enlisting, they would take the photographs in front of the building, so you can see it was considered something, a landmark to the community.
Mm-hmm.
As time has gone on and it closed down and then reopened as a mill, it's definitely the main reason why people visit Delta, along with the lakes. It's still considered a community aspect, because they host events as well, either at the mill, or the society also owns the original town hall, which is just across the Mill Creek. And so it's became now, instead of less commercial, it's still a landmark, but now it's more focused on community.
Do they have tours? Do they sell like souvenirs to folks? What's it like today?
So exactly, they do have tours. It's ran usually by summer students and by volunteers. So today I'd be involved, even though I'm no longer in school, so I'd be a volunteer, a member of the board of directors. And so it's ran as a museum from May Long Weekend, which is the third Monday in May, all the way to Labor Day Weekend, which is the first Monday in September. And then it's open by appointment and on special events. So, for instance, during Christmas, they decorate the mill up, but they put a wreath in every window, a candle. It looks quite nice.
Mm-hmm.
And so they offer these events, the tours, and they also offer events. So, for instance, in the past, they've had alcohol tastings. They've had art galleries, expositions, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so special. So special. I can just imagine it all decorated for Christmas.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. So what lessons about community preservation efforts do you hope that readers take away from your book?
One of the most important things I hope people take away is to get involved in your local community, no matter where you are. This started out as a project of four people, soon to be joined by others like Harold Russell. And in 1963, I doubt they thought they'd ever be as successful as they are. And they didn't know for sure that they had a National Historic Site in their hands. And there was still a consistent fear that this building would fall down, collapse, and be lost of time. Because one of the things also at the back was that there was a sawmill. It was made out of wood. And it had actually deteriorated, started to rot, and was lost. So there was a real fear the mill would be lost forever. But because of the determination of these four people, again, joined by others later, it wasn't, and it's turned into a community hub and will last, hopefully, for many more generations. So that's the first thing I hope to take away. And another thing, too, I hope that they start investigating things in their own community, local landmarks, and taking pride in them.
Yes. Yes, you can see it doesn't take hundreds of people, just some determination and a passion.
Exactly, exactly. A lot of determination, a little bit of luck,
yeah. And
you'll be amazed what you can do.
For sure. So how does the preservation of places like the Delta Gristmill contribute to a broader discussion about cultural heritage in Canada?
That's a great question. So again, the Delta Mill was really on the forefront of this discussion in the 1970s. There was still, so for instance, the Ontario Historical Society had only been founded a few years earlier. That was one of the foundations that the mill approached for money. And so it really proved that there was an interest in this and that it would be profitable. I've seen by today how popular the mill is for tourists and community events and visitors. There's a lot of concern. One of the things that the Ontario Historical Foundation often talked about when they were grants, that there, you have to show not only effort, that you're willing to restore this, but there's also a community and a larger interest, not just in Canada, but from other people as well, in visiting this mill and restoring it. They want to make sure that their investment, they're going to get a return on investment, so to speak, that it's worth in putting all this money into it. Mm-hmm. So it really showed that, yes, it is worth it. And if it wasn't for places like the Delta Mill, I don't know where the heritage restoration movement would be today if it wasn't a success.
Right. Fascinating. Wow. Are there any future projects or areas of research that you're planning to pursue following the completion of this book?
So yes, one of my interests is early Canadian history, and I'm currently researching a book, and hopefully soon to write it, on Bishop John Strachan of York, Toronto today. So he's quite an interesting character. Originally born in Scotland, immigrated to Canada, and he was very, very influential in the early founding and conception of what Canada was. One of his reasons why is that he was the headmaster of the Cornwall Grammar School. And this is because, again, Canada was considered on the frontier. There weren't too many educational learning areas. And so all the prominent families, more or less, would send their sons here. And so he had a huge role as their teacher. And he would often spend almost like a father figure. And as years went on, he would stay in touch with many of his students. And so he had a huge impact on the early history of Canada that way, just in because his views would undoubtedly affect the views of his students.
Where are you in that process?
Still very, very early.
Yes.
I'm finalizing my research, mm-hmm. but I'm hoping to begin writing within the next month or so.
Okay.
And I'm assuming it's going to be about a year to 2 year process.
Sure. There's a lot to research and delve into. And like any good research, once you get down a rabbit hole, sometimes you stay there for a while because you get fascinated by what you find.
Exactly. And you never know what direction you might take.
I know. You could get lost in research, actually, for sure. Well, is there anything we missed that you wanted to highlight today? We covered a lot, but I want to make sure we're not leaving something behind.
I think that was great. Thank you. The last thing I'd like to mention is that the Delta Mill Society is still doing great work for heritage preservation in Delta. And if anybody ever finds themselves in the area, please pay us a visit. We'd love to have them. Again, they're open from the May long weekend, the third Monday in May, all the way to Labor Day weekend, the first Monday in September. Right. And we have people from all over the world, the United States mostly, outside of Canada, but we also have Germany, Netherlands, and places as far away as China.
Wow. Well, there's a lot to learn and be gleaned from just visiting and then delving into the history. And obviously, your book just took it to another level. So I'm sure that your community is just so, so very pleased that you took the time to write this book.
Yes. And I hope to further help my community by doing extra research. Mm-hmm. Like, as we mentioned before, an idea of historical fiction, Idea of Delta, or also my book on John Strachan.
Right, right. Is your book available at the mill?
It is.
Good.
And there's also a PDF copy available upon request.
Excellent. All right. That's good. I'm glad it's physically in the mill so folks can get copies of it. So where can folks go to find out more about you and get copies of this book?
So the best place to find copies of the book are either please pay the Delta Mill visit. You can also go to www.deltamill.org. There's a PDF available. And there's also a PDF available from Canada, Parks Canada's website. It's not affiliated with Parks Canada, but it is still available that way. And that's for free because all I ask if people do, so the book itself costs $20, but if you get it online, all I ask if people enjoy it to leave a donation to back to the museum, however much they deem fit. Okay. And the best way to find me is either through the museum itself, or they can always reach me at jared_hayes@bell.net. And I'm always happy to talk to anybody about history or anything in general.
Excellent. All right. So it was deltamill.org is where they could find out more about the mill and the history and get a copy of your book.
Yes.
Okay. Deltamill.org. All righty. Well, we're speaking with Jared Hayes, and the book is titled From Mill to Museum, The Grassroots Preservation Effort for the Grist Mill in Delta, Ontario, Canada. I'm just so thrilled to learn about this, and I think you're going to be very inspirational to others, especially those who live in smaller towns that might have buildings or sites that need to be preserved and thought, well, I'm just one person, I can't do this. I think it's very inspiring to know that we're able to publish this book and share all of your knowledge and research. So thank you. Thank you so much for joining us at Firebird and today on Authors on Fire.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.